A History of Central Banking by Stephen Goodson. Chapter 3, Napoleon and the Bank de France. Quote, "The deadly facts herein revealed lead me to wonder that this monster interest has not devoured the whole human race." Unquote. And that's Napoleon Bonaparte on being shown an interest table. France under the Bourbons. When the Bank of England was established in 1694, one of its principal aims was to provide sufficient finance so that England could prosecute its war against France. At that time, France was the premier world power both in terms of maritime forces and territorial possessions. 4 years previously, at the Battle of Beachy Head near Eastbourne, England, the French navy defeated the Anglo-Dutch fleet comprehensively when it sank 12 ships, while a further 20 ships were exploded by their English crews. Since the 7th of June 1654, France had been ruled by its most glorious monarch, King Louis XIV, the Sun King. Louis was well versed in the wiles of the bankers. When he discovered that his superintendent of finances, Nicolas Fouquet, was a representative of what we term today the money power, and received irrefutable evidence that, quote, "he had long been betraying the trust reposed in him by mishandling the state finances and by monstrous corruption," unquote, he had him arrested. Fouquet was put on trial and sentenced to complete isolation for the rest of his life in the inaccessible fortress of Pignerol. Scrolling past a picture, sorry. The War of the Spanish Succession, 1702 to 1714, was the largest military conflict since the Crusades. It was fought after Louis declared his intention to place his grandson, Philip, Duke of Anjou, on the Spanish throne. This attempt, if successful, would have created a vast Franco-Spanish empire and posed a direct threat to the Bank of England and its proxy, the government of Great Britain. With the ability to create money out of nothing, the English were able to build a large fleet and buy the loyalty of France's enemies by bankrolling them. Louis held out for 9 years until his heirs suddenly started to die in unnatural circumstances. On the 13th of April, 1711, his heir, Louis, Le Grand Dauphin, died allegedly of smallpox, even though he had had the disease when he was a small child. On the 12th of February, 1712, the wife of his grandson, the Duke of Burgundy, died of a fever. A few days later, her husband was covered in spots, and he died on the 18th of February, 1712, of unknown causes. A few weeks later, the king's two great-grandsons fell ill with scarlet fever. The 5-year-old Duke of Brittany died on the 18th of March, 1712. The 3-year-old brother, the Duke of Anjou, survived miraculously after the king ordered his isolation and treatment with an antidote. As a result of these tragedies, the king was persuaded to cease hostilities and commence negotiations. At Utrecht, a treaty was signed in March and April 1713, which allowed France to retain largely its pre-war boundaries. Thereafter, the heirs to the French throne stopped dying, although this did not prevent the other grandson of Louis, the Duke of Berry, who was the regent of the future Louis XV, dying in an unusual, quote-unquote, riding accident. A broken man, the Sun King died of natural causes on the 1st of September, 1715. The ability of the English to command vast sums of money had not gone unnoticed by the French, who realized that the war had not been won because of a deficiency in financial credit. On the 1st of May, 1716, a Scotsman, John Law, received a patent to open a private bank, the Banque Générale, which was patterned on the Bank of England and which was entitled to issue banknotes and exchange them for gold. The regent of Louis XV, Philip II, Duke of Orleans, realized that this bank could provide government with a means of financing its expenditures and in 1718, France's first central bank came into existence and was renamed the Banque Royale. The adoption of the Bank of England paradigm of creating money ex nihilo soon enabled the French economy to recover and flourish. However, this period of prosperity was of short duration. In January 1720, the French government received a record-breaking loan of 100 million livres. The following month, news spread quickly that the bank was experiencing difficulty in exchanging its banknotes for gold coins, and an quote-unquote atrocious panic ensued. The source of these rumors is not clear, but the most likely suspect would have been the Bank of England, which wished to destroy its dangerous rival. Tongue twisters. Various attempts were made to shore up the Banque Royale. A decree of the 11th of March 1720 banned the use of coins from the 1st of May onwards. When this measure failed to staunch the impending catastrophe, a decree was announced on the 22nd of May 1720 which reduced the value of the banknotes by 50%. A third decree of the 10th of October 1720 stated that on the 1st of November, banknotes would no longer be used and that they were to be exchanged for state bonds with a further reduction of 50% in their value. On November 1720, the Banque Royale declared itself bankrupt, and its founder and controller general of finances, John Law, fled the country the following month. For the Bank of England and its Jewish stockholders, the demise of the Banque Royale was an unmitigated triumph. Napoleon, the Monetary Reformer. Napoleon, who was Emperor of France from 1804 to 1815, was very mindful of the fact that money always remains in hiding and only acts through agents who are often unaware of the aims that they are pursuing. He realized that international money stood behind every foreign enemy, every monarch, and every political party, including the Jacobins, stating on one occasion that, quote, "The hand that gives is above the hand that takes. Money has no motherland. Financiers are without patriotism and without decency. Their sole object is gain," unquote. He had very clear ideas as to how he wished the French economy to be run. He defined his system as being for the application of the resources of government, including finances, for the benefit and use of his people, for the greater glory of God. His system was for the maintenance of spiritual as against material values, the nation as against political parties, patriotism as against greed, and loyalty as against fear. The bedrock of the economy was to be agriculture, quote, "For that is the soul of the people, the foundations of the kingdom," unquote. Next in importance was industry, which, quote, ministers the comfort and happiness of the population, unquote. A poor third came foreign trade, which only consists of the surplus of agriculture and industry. In his opinion, quote, "Foreign trade ought to be the servant of agriculture and home industry. These last ought never be subordinated to foreign trade," unquote. Napoleon's ultimate objective was to ensure not only financial independence, but self-sufficiency in the production of goods for domestic consumption. Napoleon would not allow loans to be employed for current expenditure, whether civil or military, under any circumstances. On the subject of debt, he had this to say. Quote, "One has only to consider what loans can lead to in order to realize their danger. Therefore, I would never have anything to do with them and have always striven against them. At one time, people asserted that I did not issue loans because I possessed no credit and could find nobody who would lend me anything. That is quite false. That surely implies a very scanty knowledge of human nature and an ignorance of stock exchange methods if people imagine that I could find no one ready to lend. It was not part of my system," unquote. The State Bank of the French Empire. Napoleon's first act on assuming power as first consul on the 9th of November 1799 was to establish the Banque de France on the 18th of January 1800 as a joint stock company which commenced operations on the 20th of February that year. This bank replaced the 15 mainly Jewish private banking houses, which had been deeply involved in the events leading up to the Jewish Revolution against the French people, commonly but incorrectly known as the French Revolution 1789 to 1799. These banks had increased the national debt to $170 million and had charged rapacious rates of interest on loans to the French crown, to the extent that prior to 1789, it was allocating over 50% of its budget expenditure to interest. The bank was set up with a share capital of 30 million francs divided into 30,000 shares of 1,000 francs each, of which a portion was subscribed by Napoleon, his family, and members of his entourage. The dividend of the shareholders was initially limited to 6% per annum, but was increased in 1806 to two-thirds of the bank's profits, with the remaining one-third being allocated to the bank's reserves. The 200 largest shareholders elected 15 regents or directors who sat on the general council administering the bank and three censors or inspectors who supervised management of the bank. The general council in turn elected a central committee consisting of three members, one of whom was chairman. Napoleon made himself president of the bank, declaring that, quote, "The bank does not belong to the shareholders only. It also belongs to the state, since the state has entrusted it to the privilege of issuing money. I wish the bank to be in sufficient measure in the hands of the state, but not too much so." End quote. On the 14th of April, 1803, by means of an act of Parliament, Napoleon abolished the right of two rival banks, the Caisse d'Escompte de Commerce and the Comptoir Commercial, to issue banknotes. As he remarked at that time, quote, "Have you not told me that, in order to preserve credit, it is a general practice that artificial money, like that of the Bank of France, shall issue from only one source? I adopt that idea. A single bank can be more easily watched than several concerns, both by the government and the public. With a view to emergencies, I cannot see any virtue in competition of this kind." Unquote. On the 22nd of April, 1806, a new act was passed, which replaced the three-member central committee with a governor and two deputy governors. These appointments were personally vetted by Napoleon. The new act also increased the bank's capital to 90 million francs. Napoleon was so suspicious and distrustful of bankers that he personally supervised the operations of the treasury, lest the secrets of his monetary policies leak out and be exploited by speculators. He was thus his own banker, who controlled both the creation and distribution of money and credit, to the chagrin of the international bankers, particularly the Rothschilds, who were virtually excluded from operating in continental markets. Napoleon made the franc the most stable currency in Europe. After France had abandoned the loan markets of the city of London, a fog of depression settled on its fraternity of bankers and usurers. In typical fashion, the English press began to stir up trouble for Napoleon. He was accused of having not observed the conditions of the Treaty of Amiens, which had been signed between England and France on the 25th of March, 1802. Relations broke down when Napoleon refused to sign a trade treaty which would promote quote-unquote free trade and a modern-day version of globalization, and thereby force him to diminish the autarky and isolationism in his continental policy. England, under the direction of her international bankers, proceeded to bankroll Austria, Prussia, Russia, Spain, and Sweden, and duly declared war on France. The coalition forces exceeded 600,000. Napoleon could not muster even a third of that number, and would under normal circumstances have been compelled to secure a banker's loan in order to arm and feed them. On the 20th of December, 1803, he trumped the warmongers by selling Louisiana to the United States of America for £3 million. A brief period of peace and prosperity ensued. However, in 1806, a new coalition consisting of England, Russia, and Prussia at the initiative of the last-named country took the field. Although the coalition forces were defeated at Jena on the 14th of October, 1806, Napoleon was forced to engage in a series of needless and senseless wars for the next 9 years in order to protect France and her new economic dispensation. He promulgated the Continental Blockade, whose objective was to destroy England's export trade, as he realized that England could not finance her imports and fund her allies at the same time. At the Treaty of Tilsit, signed on the 7th of July, 1807, on a raft in the middle of the Niemen River in East Prussia, Napoleon and Tsar Alexander I agreed to an alliance which made them the masters of continental Europe. Alexander agreed to join Napoleon's continental blockade of England and to provide each other with mutual support in the event of disputes with other nations, and in particular the British Empire. At that time, France and Russia were the only two countries in Europe which were not on the usury system and were furthermore not indebted to the Rothschilds. They were therefore the only free and independent nations. However, a few years later, Russia started to violate the blockade. This action was premised on the fact that Russia, a producer of mainly raw materials, had very little industrial capacity and had been dependent on England for the importation of industrial products. Alexander was only prepared to continue with the blockade, subject to France supplying him with the industrial goods which he had previously imported from England. France could not supply these goods, as England commanded the seas and there was no road or rail infrastructure in Europe at that time. Therefore, in order to enforce the blockade, Napoleon decided to invade Russia on the 24th of June, 1812, with an army of over 500,000 soldiers. Although he reached Moscow on the 14th of September, 1812, he found that it had been abandoned, and the subsequent winter retreat turned into a major disaster, with only 110,000 of his original army surviving. The following year, Napoleon was defeated at the quote-unquote Battle of the Nations, east of Leipzig, on the 19th of October, 1813. On the 11th of April, 1814, he abdicated at Fontainebleau. After being banished to the island of Elba, situated between Corsica and Tuscany, Napoleon attempted to stage a comeback at the Battle of Waterloo in modern-day Belgium on the 18th of June, 1815. All the belligerents, England, Prussia, and France, were financed by Nathan Rothschild, with France receiving a loan of £10 million. After his defeat, Napoleon was exiled to the British island of St. Helena in the South Atlantic, where he died under suspicious circumstances when he was still a fit man at the age of 51, on the 5th of May, 1821. An examination of Napoleon's remains has indicated that he almost certainly died of cyanide poisoning following chronic arsenic intoxication. In such a case, it would undoubtedly have been the work of a Rothschild assassin, which conforms to a pattern repeated consistently during the past two centuries of assassinating all leaders who propose, institute, or maintain systems of usury-free banking. As a part of Napoleon's plan to assimilate Jews into French society, he issued a decree in 1808 ordering all Jews to adopt surnames and to use those names on all documents. Napoleon, in a letter to his younger brother Jerome, written in 1808, states, quote, "I have undertaken to reform the Jews, but I have not endeavored to draw more of them into my realm. It is necessary to reduce, if not destroy, the tendency of Jewish people to practice a very great number of activities that are harmful to civilization and to public order and society in all the countries of the world. It is necessary to stop the harm by preventing it. To prevent it, it is necessary to change the Jews. Once part of their youth will take its place in our armies, they will cease to have Jewish interests and sentiments. Their interests and sentiments will be French." Unquote. Achievements of the French State Banking System. As part of the Code Napoleon, Code Civil des François, Napoleon introduced a new commercial code on the 21st of March, 1804. These economic reforms, which included substantially reduced taxes, quickly turned the French economy around and resulted in increased trade and development of new industries, such as cotton making and sugar beet, which were assisted by tariffs against foreign goods and low interest rate loans. The infrastructure was upgraded on a vast scale not only in France, but throughout Western Europe, with the construction of 20,000 miles of imperial roads and 12,000 miles of regional roads, almost 1,000 miles of canals, bridges, the dredging and expansion of harbors such as Cherbourg and Dunkirk, waterworks and public buildings such as the gallery at the Louvre, all financed with interest-free money from the Banque de France. Napoleon also established an industrial board which provided data and information to French industry. The Imperial University, which administered French education, specialized schools or lycées for the study of engineering, science and technology, and professional schools devoted to midwifery, obstetrics, and veterinary science. Napoleon described these accomplishments to his Irish doctor, Barry O'Meara, on the island of St. Helena, and said they were his most enduring monument. Quote, "The Allied powers cannot take from me hereafter the great public works I have executed, the roads which I made over the Alps, and the seas I have united. They cannot place their feet to improve where mine have not been before. They cannot take from the code of laws which I formed and which will go down to posterity." Unquote. In conclusion, we may consider some of Napoleon's achievements, which he communicated to his former chamberlain and constant companion for 18 months on St. Helena, Comte de las Casas, quote, "I inspired France and Europe with new ideas which will never be forgotten. France's finances are the best in the world. To whom does she owe them? If I had not been overthrown, I would have made a complete change in the appearance of commerce as well as of industry. The efforts of the French people were extraordinary. Prosperity and progress were growing immeasurably. Enlightenment was making giant strides. New ideas were everywhere heard and published, for I took pains to introduce science among the people. If I had been given time, there would have soon been no more artisans in France. They would have all become artists." Unquote.